And thanks for being with me on this edition of Fantasia. Stay tuned for the BBC News and the 8 o'clock buzz, which will follow that here where you're tuned WORTFM 89.9 Madison. And we go out with a reference to Richard Strauss's Metamorphoses for 23 solo strings.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. Belgium has opened an investigation into suspected Russian interference in the European Parliament just weeks before the June elections. Belgium's Prime Minister Alexander De Croo said Europe needed to combat interference from Moscow. Nick Beek is in Brussels.
He said there was evidence that some members of the European Parliament had been paid, and although these transactions weren't made here on Belgian soil, because Belgium is home to the key EU institutions, it was Belgium's duty to investigate. If you look at the bigger picture, these elections that take place between the 6th and 9th of June, already there was a lot of concern about the far-right parties, who, according to opinion polls, are set to do pretty well in this. They've talked in more favourable terms about Russia and also have been talking about decreasing support for Ukraine.
US officials have warned that Iran could launch a major attack on Israel as soon as today in retaliation for last week's airstrike on an Iranian diplomatic compound in Syria. The prospect has raised fears of a wider conflict in the Middle East. Hugo Beshega is in Jerusalem.
A U.S. official has told CBS News that a major Iranian attack could include more than 100 drones, dozens of cruise missiles, and perhaps ballistic missiles. Military interests in Israel would be the targets, the official added, saying there was still a possibility that Iran could decide to hold back. An attack of this magnitude would inevitably trigger an Israeli retaliation. A top U.S. general has been sent to Israel to discuss the Iranian threat and a possible Israeli response.
The mayor of the city of Orenburg in Russia's southern Urals has ordered citizens threatened by flooding to evacuate immediately as waters reach what he called extremely dangerous levels. Sergei Salmin stressed that the sirens they could hear were not a drill, urging them to take documents, medicines and other essentials. Oleg Boldarev has more details.
The waters are expected to peak today, but what they've already done is pretty bad. Hundreds and hundreds of houses, the one, two-story ones, have been flooded. There are large residential complexes, the high-rises, which are under threat now. If the water gets into those, obviously the damage will grow more and more, and it's already very substantial. The local governor said the first estimates of damage is at about $420 million.
A medical agency working in Sudan has warned that levels of hunger and malnutrition after a year of civil war are much worse than previously thought. Médecins Sans Frontières and other organisations say the breakdown of governance and infrastructure means famine is now almost inevitable. The UN has said Sudan could become the world's worst hunger crisis. World news from the BBC.
Please join us on Monday, April 15 at 7 p.m. for a very special Access Hours. We are proud to present
Turning Points.
Students' Voice from East High School.
We are a diverse student's body with hopes and dreams.
We come from across the globe.
We are your neighbors.
We are your friends.
We are your children.
We are here with you and we invite you to hear our story.
That's Monday, April 15 from 7 to 8 p.m. on the Access Hour.
No means, but no.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Arts and Literature Laboratory, Madison's community-based contemporary arts center located at 111 South Livingston Street. Arts and Literature Laboratory houses an art gallery and performance space, a writing center and library, artist studios, and a dedicated education studio, which features classes for all ages. Information about current exhibits, performances, and classes, and how to get involved as a member or volunteer is available at artlitlab.org or on social media at artlitlab.
Friday, 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. What a sight coming in this morning. Actually, you know, the sun being out and everything, that's a bonus. But when I was driving parallel to Lake Monona, there it was. It's that ski team, ski ramp. Somebody put that up in the last 24 hours or 48 hours. That makes me so happy. The only thing this time of year that makes me happier than seeing that ski ramp out there is the B.B. Clark diving board raft. When that baby gets out there, gets chained to the bottom for the summer, and they put that board on that raft, I'm like, rock and roll. Okay, let's go for today's show. Gotta get ready. And I know a lot of you are. Next Tuesday's total eclipse of the sun. It's going to be spectacular. The weather's predicted to be clear in the upper Midwest. I just checked. So if that holds, and Menards, I understand, is giving away those special glasses for free. Obviously, that's equipment that you'll need if you're making plans to observe.
Andy, just a second,
please. Hang on, if you would. Of course, a lot of you may be listening to this even as you drive out of town to get closer to what they call the zone of totality. I love that phrase. So some of you may be on your way even now to the zone of totality. People in parts of Ohio and Indiana, I understand, will have a view of the entire eclipse on Tuesday. It's a once or twice, I guess, in a lifetime opportunity.
Andy,
Jim, what is it?
That was this week. That happened. It happened on Monday. It already happened.
Oh, man. My mistake. I'm reading from last week's script. That's sloppy. That's kind of embarrassing. No, thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim Wilson, for once again saving me from myself. All right, let's get on the right track here. Okay, here we go. Let's start over. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. Lots of you, I know, enjoyed the big celebration last night at the Majestic, honoring the life and legacy of the late funky drummer Clyde Stubblefield. It was an all-star turnout on the stage and off the stage at the Majestic last night. Later this morning, we'll talk about Clyde's life and work and listen to some of his most important cuts.
Andy, that show's next week.
I'm sorry, Encore? What do you have?
Andy, the Clyde Stubblefield show at the Majestic is next week, next Thursday night.
It's what now?
Next Thursday night, the show we're talking about?
Yeah.
Clyde Stubblefield birthday tribute at the Majestic? Yeah. It hasn't happened. You know, it's happening on April 18.
This is messed up. This is a horrible way to start the show. I see I'm reading off from next week's script now. Jesus Christ. Good God. Okay. Oh, man. Rocky start here, fellas. Let's get this dialed in. Okay. Here we go. Third time's the charm. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. Let me see here. Oh, God. April 12th. There it is. I did it. I'm Andy Moore. At least I got that part right. But here's the real deal for today. It was, for real, a big news in the week, in the world of AI. this week, did you notice all the Microsoft announced like almost $2 billion investment in AI research with Japan later in the hour? We'll actually check in with a leading AI researcher who runs a lab in Huntsville, Alabama. A rep from Planned Parenthood, Wisconsin, joins us at half past the hour to go over implications of the Arizona State Supreme Court decision on abortion and to talk about the swelling political tide that is abortion in November elections. And in just a couple minutes, we'll visit with the Madison editor of a science fiction zine. And that zine has been nominated for the prestigious Hugo Award. Very big deal. Keeping me on track all the way through the show, as we've already learned. Engineer without peer, Jim Wilson. Music producer, Ankur Malhotra, who will also have Ankur's picks for live music for the weekend. And our front desk supervisor and online producer, Elliot LeBrun. Thank God you guys are here. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. Let's get buzzing. Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. We were having fun with the this week's eclipse in the show open, if you're just joining us. But engineer without peer, Jim Wilson, made the trip south. And real quickly, Jim, what did you experience down there? What happened and what did you see?
Well, it was pretty incredible. Actually, this is the second total solar eclipse I saw at the same exact location down in southern Illinois. I went and saw it in 2017 as well. And this time, some of the things that really stood out to me were the crickets. Were going nuts, maybe 20 minutes before totality. And then, of course, once you get into totality, you can hear everybody else that's watching it start cheering, and people were launching fireworks, and just like the whole like 360-degree view around you looks like just past sunset, where the sun's just below the horizon and illuminating the distance, but it's in every direction. And then you look up, you can see the solar corona. There's actually really cool prominence, solar prominence that was sticking out. And then you could also see some of the planets that you normally don't see in the daytime.
God. Oh, thank you for that summary. I find that the bio response with the crickets is kind of the most sensational of all. Thanks so much, Jim. And we're glad you made it back safe as well. I don't think it's an awkward transition at all to go from what we experienced this week in outer space to talking about some very exciting science fiction developments with someone who is now nominated for a very special prize in that form. The Hugo Awards have been awarded annually since 1955 as part of Worldacon. That's the World Science Fiction Convention. This year, the Hugos will be presented on August 18th. In Glasgow, Scotland. As one of the most prestigious awards in genre writing, the awards are presented to specific works of science fiction or fantasy, and to people with a body of work in science fiction or fantasy appearing in the preceding calendar year, so in this case it'll be 2023. It wouldn't be any fun on a science fiction award if it was in this same year. I don't know if our first guest will attend the Glasgow ceremonies. We'll ask her. But we do know that LaShawn Wanick's sci-fi zine based in Madison is nominated for a Hugo. Giga Notosaurus is the name of the zine. LaShawn Wanick is the editor, and she joins us now. Good morning, LaShawn, and welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Good morning. Hi. Welcome. Glad to be here.
Congratulations to you. A big congratulations to you. What a big deal. How did you find out about the nomination?
They notified us 2 weeks before the big announcement, and they've actually sent me an email, and I hadn't actually checked my email for the magazine because I was busy doing other things. So they actually had to reach me on LinkedIn to say, hey, we sent you an email. And I woke up on Saturday morning with this LinkedIn message, and I was like, oh, I better check and see. And went and checked my email, and there it was, the announcement that we've been nominated. And it utterly floored me. I was like, holy cow.
Yes. So what a thing to wake up to.
Yeah.
It's one thing, you know, if you checked your email in the middle of the day, but here you are fisting your eyes open, and there it was. And it you say it just floored you?
It did, yeah. I was not expecting that. We're a very small magazine. We only put out one short story a month, between 5,000 and 25,000 words.
That's even more remarkable. That the format should be honored in that way with a nomination. I want to ask you more specifically about Giganotosaurus in a moment. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
Oh boy, I practiced it. I'm happy about that. So I do want to get more into the publication more specifically, but I want to have the listeners hear you talk about how you got into the genre in the first place. I understand it was maybe through family members, did you not? Can you tell us how your interest in the genre began?
Yeah. So when I was growing up, my grandma, Mary Fuqua, she was very much into reading. She died about a couple of years ago. But she always loved to read, and her house was filled with all these books. And she would read in any genre, history, romance, literary, horror. But she also read science fiction, and she also subscribed to a magazine called Omni Magazine.
And I remember that magazine.
It had gorgeous pictures, but it also had short stories. And I used to be I loved books even when I was a kid. My mom said that I didn't speak until I was 4 years old, and even back then I was reading books higher than what normal kids would read. So I was a little nerd back then. One of the things I used to do was read Omni Magazine and read the stories in it. And it just, there was something about the genre that just took a hold of me. And I was like, I love this. And so ever since then, you know, whenever we go to visit my grandma's, she would always give me a pile of fantasy and science fiction books. And I would just devour them.
Along the way, as you got more formally or more singularly into the form, and you discovered a Black culture and legacy in the genre, did you not?
I did, but it's so funny story. Yeah, I didn't fully get really immersed into the Black writers of the genre until I actually moved here in Madison. I mean, I was aware of Octavia Butler. Obviously my grandma had her books. But it wasn't until I moved here and got involved with the science fiction community here. A friend of mine introduced me at the time it was a feminist science fiction book club. And they told me about WISCON, which is the science fiction convention that happens here every year. And they told me I should go. And I went in, we moved here in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
I went for the first time in 2009 and was absolutely like, these are my people.
Oh.
You know, because WISCON is a feminist science fiction convention, and I've never heard of that before. Mm. I thought science fiction conventions were all about, you know, Star Wars and Star Trek and things of that nature. And no, it was so much more than that. And for the first time, I actually got to meet Black people who also read science fiction and fantasy and were interested in the same things as I was, like anime and things like that. And I was like, I'm home.
Oh,
these are my people.
What a great discovery. And then to be embraced and embrace that those folks and those people in the same boat as you. What was the first work? You mentioned several in a generic way. If you can recall, Sean, what was the first work of science fiction you remember reading specifically that called you further into the forum, that said, come on in?
Oh my gosh, I have to really think, because
we can come back to it. Anything coming to mind, maybe just in a quick, nimble way?
I do know, like, I was involved, the first book that I actually remember reading and really getting into was the Narnia books by C.S. Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. So as a kid growing up, my mom was Christian. So we all went to church and all that. And this was actually before I didn't know that C.S. Lewis was a Christian writer until like a little bit later. But at the time, you know, his Narnia books was pretty much the very first thing that I really latched on to.
Yeah.
And I actually remember as a kid, like reading them aloud to my sisters before we would go to school. And so, and I would do all the voices too. Like, there's a mouse called Reepy Cheep. So mm-hmm. I would talk in a high voice to talk about, when I read Reepy Cheep's voice. And
if you're just joining us, I'm talking with LaShawn Wannick, the editor of the sci-fi zine Giganotosaurus. The zine was just nominated for the genre's highest literary honor, the Hugo. LaShawn, I noticed the word speculative is used to label this kind mm-hmm. of literature. What does that term mean to you?
Yeah, so we say science fiction, but obviously there's a lot more, the genre is more widespread. So I myself, I when I do writing, I write science fiction, but I find myself a lot more drawn to fantasy. So speculative is basically inclusive of that. So it's anything that goes beyond the real world. So magic realism would fall in that category.
Mm-hmm.
Horror would fall in that category, things of that nature. It's more of a, and basically stories that don't fit in either genre. So my stories tend to sometimes slide between science fiction and fantasy, because I'm usually, I just like being in that space where anything is possible. Doesn't have to be strictly science fiction or fantasy. So
As I was preparing for this segment, and I bumped into that word speculative the first time, and it kind of put me off because I said, what, and I thought about it a little further, and then it made all the sense in the world to me. Since when I think of the word speculative, in my mind, it means along the lines of yet to be determined or proved. And that's sort of in the wheelhouse of sci-fi, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It makes you think.
Yes.
And that's the whole purpose. And that's why I love the genre so much, because stories like that make you think and ponder and make you consider possibilities that you normally don't think of. So, and that's what I strive for when I read stories for Giganotosaurus. Stories that are really, they stimulate your brain and help you ponder deep questions, but also do it in a way that's literary and, yes, that calls attention to beautiful language and things of that nature.
Let's continue down that lane. In more specific terms, do you look for as the editor in a submitted story? What are the ingredients that you're hoping will make the recipe for a story that worthy of a Giganotosaurus?
That is a very good question, because I've been trying to figure that out myself. It's like, what draws me to, saying, okay, this story will be published? And it could be a number of things. I usually say it's stories that surprise me or catch me off guard. Stories that do have a deep meaning. I will say that my Christian faith does cause me to go out and, I'm really drawn to stories about faith in general. Mm-hmm. So especially stories about people wrestling with faith, people losing faith, people finding faith, faith changing to something else. And of course, that also goes, my stories also tend to have a slight feminist bent because, I love stories about empowered women and things like that. I also am striving to use the magazine as a way for queer authors and trans authors to able to tell their stories. So I eagerly seek those out. But then stories that are just good, which I know that's very, very subjective, but
yes.
The last story that I just published, called The Grandmother The Grandmother Hypothesis by J.S. Richardson, is about a woman who has created a time machine, and she basically travels different worlds, to see what life would have been like for her daughter, who only lived a few moments after birth. So, it then turns into this story of, discovery. And, it's also a story about grief. But it's also a story about, coming to terms, with life,
yes.
Which, it's kind of hard for us for times, universe slipping, story, but J.S. Richardson did it in a way that completely captivated me. So
how cool. It's almost as though the preposterousness of a science fiction story opens your mind to anything and everything.
It does. It does. And yeah, that's how short stories, in particular short stories. I like it for novels too, but I always had a soft spot for short stories because it does it in a way that's constrained by word count. So you have to get your point across in a restricted, limited amount of words. And you can do wonderful, beautiful things with that.
If you're just jumping in, LaShawn Wanick is the editor of the sci-fi zine Giganotosaurus. The zine was just nominated for the genre's highest literary honor, the Hugo. I want to backtrack just for a moment in the remaining couple, 2 or 3 minutes that we have, LaShawn. And I don't feel like we've done justice to sort of the history of Giganotosaurus. Could you give us a little 30-second synopsis on that?
Yeah. Giganotosaurus was founded in 2011 by Ann Leckie. And Ann Leckie, by her own right, is an amazing author. I highly, highly recommend people picking up her books. And I'm sort of blanking right now on the books she wrote. But she actually is on this year's ballot, believe it or not, for the Hugos. She's also been nominated for Best Novel and Best Series.
Oh my.
So imagine our surprise.
Right.
that was actually the second great surprise, yes. You know, when we found out that we were on the same ballot. And it was like, for her, it's like things have come full circle.
Oh my.
So she was very, very excited to see us on the same ballot.
Do you plan to go to Glasgow in August for the Hugo Award presentations?
Yes, I do.
Oh, yay.
I will.
Good.
I'll
Good.
Be going. Oh, it's going to be crazy.
Maybe we'll be able to have you back and hear about what it was like. Regular listeners know that when we're fortunate enough to have an author, writer, or poet, which you are all three, we like to ask them to read a piece of their work, and you and I spoke about this prior to this segment. And so if you'd be so kind, in the minute or so we have left, would you set up and share one of your poems? And I know poetry is something that's not exactly on your focus anymore, because once you got that pay grade raised to editor, you've got other fish to fry. But if you could set up the poem and read it to us, would you please do that now?
Yeah. I mean, I still write, short stories and all that. But yeah, on occasion, I do write poetry. And with this one, I wrote this one. It's called The Last Walk Home. The offices that I worked at, I used to work at a nonprofit. We switched. We moved to a bigger building. But the old building was closer to my house, so I could walk home every day, which was great, for raising, my son. We got to walk him to school and then walk him to work. And so the new building was a little further for us. So, and then there were other stuff that was happening, too, that was sort of some hard things. This instance happened that was absolutely real, and once I got home, I wrote a poem about it. So, The Last Walk Home. After I pack up my cubicle and tell the movers where our stuff is, I decide to walk home because it's the last time I can do so. Halfway there, I reach the corner where a mother and her two girls are waiting for the bus. The younger girl, with beads in her hair, looks up to me. "I like your shirt." And then, shyly, she touches a finger to my side, as if proving to herself I was real. A minivan pulls up in front of us. The driver sticks her head out. "Hey, y'all, how y'all doing?" The older girl replies, "I know you. What's your name?" The woman says, "My name is Tweety Bird." Then, "I have two working teenagers," as she drives off, leaving us behind in the lingering smell of lilac, beneath the harsher scent of rain-soaked pavement, a reminder that the world continues in chaotic flux, and moments such as this can be stronger than grief.
LaShawn Wanick, thank you so much for sharing that and for joining us on the Friday Buzz.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great weekend. LaShawn Wanick, you're so welcome. It's the editor of the sci-fi zine Giganotosaurus. The zine was just nominated, as we've been speaking to, for the genre's highest literary honor, the Hugo. Alrighty then. Lots more Friday Buzz ahead at about 8:45, 8:50. Dr. Ron Broward, a researcher in Huntsville, Alabama, will join us to talk about the big news this week surrounding AI, namely Microsoft's $2.9 billion investment in research with Japan. And in just a few minutes, after Encore's Picks, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin will guide us through the week's political developments regarding abortion care. This is Back Porch Community Radio, WRT-FM on South Bedford Street in Madison, Wisconsin, WRTFM.org online. It's 8:34.
Scientist, it was a bit surprising if the girl blinded me with something. Hello.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
I feel lucky. I feel lucky.
Wartstock is coming to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th, and we're holding a raffle with some great prizes. Winners will take home one of five Summer Music Festival weekend passes, and we've added dinner for six with tequila tastings at Migrants, worth over $700, a pair of season passes to Forward Theater, stays from Marquette and Ruby Marie Hotels, and a crystal and onyx necklace from Goodman's Jewelers. Gift certificates from Sardine, Orange Tree Imports, 10-pin alleys, and much, much more. Plus, merch from Wine and Hop Shop, and of course, some great wart swag. Tickets are $3 each, 2 for 5 and 5 for 10. Drawing is at 5 p.m. at Wartstock, but you do not need to be present to win. Tickets are available at upcoming wart events or at the station. A complete list of prizes is on our website at wartfm.org. Good luck.
I feel lucky today.
Hey, It's Friday 8 o'clock buzz. Every week at this time, we open the door to your entertainment world in the days to come. And that's because it's time for Encore's Picks for Live Music in the coming weekend. And now, here's Jim Wilson with the Encore's Picks disclaimer.
Encore's Picks are not influenced by any outside entities. Encore consults with an advisory board of one, Encore Malhotra. The cost of admission to any recommended show is of no concern to Encore, nor the price of beer, nor the cleanliness of the venue restrooms. Encore has one goal and one goal only in the delivery of Encore's Picks, for you to have a kick-ass musical experience. Encore's Picks is a trademark of the multinational corporation DJ Spin Cycle. All copy and trade therein is solely possessed. Here's Encore Malhotra!
Good morning, Madison. And, hope you got out of the dark, the shadow of totality.
Took a while there at the top of the show, didn't it, Encore?
Absolutely, yeah. You took me back into the dark ages. But tonight, you get your groove going with jams at Rumania Courtyard with Colette from L.A. and Azza. Tomorrow, Occidental Brothers Dance Band International Blue Stem Jazz Series, that's happening at the Harmony Bar. That's Saturday night tomorrow. April 14th, Shemekia Copeland at the High Noon Saloon. I remember seeing her at the High Noon, I guess more than a decade ago, so good to have her back in town. April 18th, that's next week, Andy.
Next week. Okay,
next week. Got it. Majestic, it's the Clyde Stubblefield Tribute with Funky JB's, VO5, DJ Kaboom Box. All that happening this week and next week. Your picks from Encore here.
Thank you, Encore. Thank you, kind sir. Segment two, it's the Friday, 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. The Arizona Supreme Court on Tuesday upheld a 160-year-old law that bans abortions and punishes doctors who provide them, saying the ban that existed before Arizona became a state can be enforced going forward. The ruling indicated the ban cannot be retroactively enforced, and the court stayed enforcement for 14 days. But the shocking ruling quickly caused a political earthquake. You could say that the politics of abortion will cause tremors on a regular basis between now and the November general election. We want to consider this week's Arizona ruling on its own, and as it casts an important, relevant shadow over the abortion care political debate in the coming months with our next guest. Annalise Eicher is the Director of Communications for Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Annalise, good morning and welcome to the Friday Buzz, and please forgive us for running a little bit late.
No worries. Good morning, and thank you so much for having me this morning.
Yes, thank you. Annalise, how does the Arizona decision call, in your opinion, for federal law reform, not state, that protects abortion care?
Well, I want to start by talking about the decision in Arizona, and it's in Arizona, so why should we be caring about it here in Wisconsin?
Yes.
We should be caring and looking at all of these decisions because at the end of the day, it harms these decisions harm people in our lives and in our communities about who we care deeply, and I think similarly to Arizona, I think it's important to remember that in Wisconsin, we have a law that's older than the one in Arizona, and that law is still on the books. And so future courts, because we don't have a federal protection for abortion care and the right to bodily autonomy, there's future courts could change their mind about the enforceability of a law in Arizona, about the enforceability of a law in Wisconsin, I think it just reinforces for us the need for states to explicitly give constitutional rights to bodily autonomy, and that includes the right to reproductive rights like abortion care.
Let's stay in Wisconsin for a moment. The judicial wheels on abortion care have been spinning hard in the last 2 years in particular, and I suspect when the public sees changes in other states, people start to get confused with the noise of it all, or start to misunderstand or even forget what's available in their own state. This may be more fundamental of a question than I mean it to be. But for clarification purposes, tell our listeners what the legal status of abortion care is right now in Wisconsin.
Yeah, in the state of Wisconsin right now, abortion care is legal. We have a number of restrictions that unfortunately do impact folks' ability to get the care that they need, but abortion is legal in Wisconsin. Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin has a center in a health center in Milwaukee, a health center in Madison, at which you can receive all forms of abortion care. And then up in Sheboygan at our health center, you can receive medication abortion care. There's also affiliated medical services, which was reopened in Milwaukee. So abortion care is legal and available in the state of Wisconsin at this moment.
In February, Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin asked our state Supreme Court to interpret Wisconsin's constitution as it relates to making decisions about whether and when to have a child, including the right to choose to have an abortion. Walk us through that petition, if you would, and where is that case currently?
Yeah, thank you for that. So we, I think there's been a lot of attention on the case that the Attorney General filed. And, you know, we've been in support of that litigation since. But, you know, we ultimately think that this needs to go a step further and that there needs to be a state constitutional protection for the right to bodily autonomy, which includes the right to abortion, when and if you're able to decide, you know, when and how you're going to have a family that includes, you know, biological children. And so that case is, and our petition, our ask for the Supreme Court of Wisconsin to consider that question is still with the Supreme Court. They have not yet scheduled anything in regards to the Attorney General's case. They have not yet said that they will accept our petition for original action. You know, we, of course, think we made, we have an incredible stance and position, and that this is the time, if they're going to be considering what the AG brought forward, what AG Call brought forward with the challenge to the 1849 law, that this is absolutely the time that we can put a constitutional protection for the right to abortion in our state constitution.
Let's briefly ease into the politics for a moment. All seven of the Arizona High Court justices were appointed by Republican governors. The Arizona governor is a Democrat, and she gave enforcement of the abortion ban, as you know, to the state attorney general, also a Democrat, Chris Mays, who had this to say, quote, "No woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this law as long as I am attorney general." Annalise Eichert, this paints the picture of the politics of abortion in 2024 as well as anything else, does it not?
I think it does. And, it's I think similarly here in Wisconsin, and I think also what we've, you know, seen nationally. There are a number of people who have supported banning abortion for a very long time. I think we're seeing that play out in Arizona. I think we saw that play out here in Wisconsin. I think we certainly saw that play out at the national level. And these folks are now realizing that their positions that they've taken and on abortion and how unpopular and unsupported they are now trying to backtrack. But the reality is that not only, you know, the overwhelming majority of the people in this country, but also, you know, I think explicitly in the state of Wisconsin, there is strong and clear support for the right to abortion care.
Finally, people in Wisconsin are feeling so urgent about this. What is your advice to people, to the electorate, with regards to how people can get off the bench and work for this issue in the coming months prior to the November election?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin runs a year-round organizing and community engagement program. And so folks are engaged on everything from standard civic engagement and voter registration to education about the issues. And so, you know, there are our Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin organizers in almost every community across Wisconsin. Folks can get involved at, if they, you know, look up the, it's Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin. They can get involved. They've got a presence on I think every single social media platform on the internet and are out doing the work every single day. And a lot of this starts with conversations with our friends and our families. And some people think that's a challenge. Yeah. This is a hard issue for some folks to talk about. And the organizers and staff of the Planned Parenthood Advocates of Wisconsin are able to coach and help folks through that entire process.
And Elise Eichert, thank you for joining us on the Friday Bus.
Thank you.
You're so welcome. Annalise Eichert, the Director of Communications for Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. We're going to take a very brief music break, and then we'll be right back with the very latest on AI. And we're going to have music, and speaking of music, I'm excited to tell you really quickly about a guest we have scheduled for next Friday, no fooling. That's when we'll be joined by legendary San Antonio rock musician Alejandro Escovedo. That'll really be fun. I'm looking forward to that. Okay, the world of AI is next here on the most community-supported back porch radio station anywhere, WRT-FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin, WRTFM.org on online. It's 8:50.
Caption. Caption.
Segment 3. Giganto news this week in the world of AI. The University of Washington and Amazon they partnered up with Japanese companies and other universities in Japan to further the innovation of AI, as if it needed further innovation, through a $110 million initiative. That was announced on Tuesday. On the same day, Microsoft announced plans to invest, and $110 million sounds like popcorn compared to this. Also on Tuesday, Microsoft announced plans to invest $2.9 billion over the next 2 years. People like to say B as in billion, so I'll do it. $2.9 billion over the next 2 years to increase its AI infrastructure in Japan. All of this came with a confluence. The two announcements coincided with a visit by Japan's prime minister to Washington, where he was expected to speak at length about AI with President Joe Biden. So lots of AI happening. The developments are not only being closely watched by the business world, of course, but also the scientific community. One observer is internationally known AI specialist, Dr. Ron Broward. It's an honor to actually be able to get him on the show this morning. Dr. Broward and his lab are based in Huntsville, Alabama. He joins us now by phone. Dr. Broward, good morning and welcome to the Friday Bus.
Morning, Andy. Thank you so much for having me. I feel like I should kind of say, for complete transparency, I'm not completely up to speed on all the news that you just shared, but I'm more than happy to talk about, you know, in general terms, the status of AI. It's a really exciting time for the field.
That's just fine, and it's why we ask you on in the first place. Let me ask you this. 10 or 15 years ago, could you have imagined that the science and application of AI would have taken off like this?
Well, I mean, yes and no. Science itself is like a wild animal. And, this field has kind of grown in complexity and breadth alongside, you know, other scientific fields that are related to it. And, the researchers at my Huntsville lab have been, seen widespread benefits of the growing AI research and development, pretty much anywhere you look.
Do you think that maybe things in AI are moving too fast?
Too fast? No, not at all. I mean, 20 years ago, AI research and advancement was in the hands of a very limited number of people in a comparatively small number of universities and private mm-hmm. scientific firms. And now, you know, it's more the merrier, honestly. people all over the country, particularly in rural America, are seeing massive gains due to these advancements.
The researchers at place, wait, what are the advantages? What are the specific advantages to AI breakthroughs for rural people?
For rural people? I mean, think about it, Andy. Money, at the end of the day. I mean, you know, reproduction is money for people in the farm field as well as the scientific field.
I guess that's true. I just never think about farmers when I think about new developments in AI.
well, you know, their lives are touched by AI on a almost daily basis for a lot of these you know, farmers and people working in that industry. I mean, you could argue that rural Americans have a much larger and I'd say more nuanced understanding of AI than any other population in the U.S., certainly more than, you know, the average person in a city center.
It's a new twist for me. AI and farmers, it almost seems confusing, but I suppose they're encountering it in the same way as everyone else.
I mean, more so than other people, I would say.
Well, more so? How is that?
In AI?
Yeah, AI.
Well, I mean, I guess I'll put it to you this way, Andy. How many people do you know in suburban or urban areas, I'd say outside of actual practicing doctors, who are practicing any form of artificial insemination on a daily basis? Does that make sense?
Am I missing
something here? Artificial insemination research, especially as you were saying earlier, has grown at incredible rates for the past dozen years. It's so much so that...
I'm sorry. Dr. Broward.
Yeah?
This is pretty freaky. You said artificial insemination.
Yeah, that's right. AI is taking off, and ranches and farms around the country are reaping benefits.
AI. That's right. I asked my producer to find someone to come on and talk about AI.
And that's what you got, Andy.
Is there
a miscommunication?
I think there must be. I'm going to have to talk with my producer, but he agreed to book us a talk with an AI, artificial intelligence. AI expert.
Well, you got an artificial insemination expert, is what you got. And honestly, Andy, you should have a talk with that producer.
Why?
I'm going to be honest. He was pushy.
That's not good.
He just came for the producer of a community-based radio show. He came off strong.
That's just not good. And this is just
awkward. Producer guy isn't doing you any favor. You got to put a leash on this guy.
Really?
Producer, he's a pit bull. He was rude, and I'm honestly surprised I even agreed to come on this program
to talk about AI.
That's right.
Well, Dr. Broward, it's embarrassing. I apologize for our mistake, and I just...
Are you going to apologize for how rude that producer was?
And for how rude that guy was.
Okay.
Ron Broward, again.
I'm a busy man over here.
We're very sorry for intruding on your morning, but thank you, anyway, for joining us on the Friday Buzz.
All right. I guess have a good weekend.
All right. Thank you. Ron Broward is an AI specialist, apparently, as in artificial insemination in Huntsville, Alabama. He was portrayed by Portland, Oregon actor, producer, and stand-up comedian Riley McCarthy. In Madison, you can follow Riley McCarthy's madness on his Instagram account, Riley Can Dunk. I think that Riley dunked that. Riley McCarthy, it's too early to be doing this nonsense. Thank you so much for joining us from Portland. And thank you, dear listener. We had a fun hour. I think we packed a lot in. We finally got the timeline right. And we hope you had a great eclipse week. I mentioned it earlier. I'm really excited about a pre-scheduled guest for next Friday. The great San Antonio, Texas rock songwriter Alejandro Escovedo will be here. We'll probably lead the show. That'll happen probably about 8:10. Really looking forward to that. Thank you so much for listening to us through our new soundboard, engineered by Jim Wilson. Encore Malhotra with the picks and the tunage this morning. We are always grateful for the Friday Buzz team. Charlie Pittman is the news and talk director at WRT-FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. WRTFM.org online. Have a great damn weekend. Aloha kamaaina.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Friday, April 12th.
This is Bird Note. But before Bird Note existed, John Kessler was recording the sounds of Seattle for public radio station KPLU, now called KNKX. From the ferry whistle to the space needle elevator operator.
Welcome to the elevator.
To salmon leaping in a stream. But after 100 or so of these sounds, John was feeling stumped.
I was like, what makes sound? What makes sound? And I was like, oh, wait, birds. Birds make sound.
He connected with some local birders to find the best spots in the city.
I saw some amazing stuff that I had no idea was there, like the Great Blue Heron Rookery at the Ballard Locks. They took me to hear winter wrens at a park overlooking Puget Sound. They also sent me with a grebe expert at Green Lake. 100 feet from a four-lane highway, there's these beautiful birds making their little nests on top of the lily pads.
Shortly after, Bird Note's founder, Chris Peterson, sought out John's musical ear to help create a sound-rich show highlighting the joy of birds. John worked as Bird Note's senior producer for over 18 years. Recently retired from the show, birds are still a part of John's life. He uses a recording device outside his home to keep track of his local feathered friends. And he's hoping to spend a little more time